Good morning, friends. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Wednesday, March 23rd, Wednesday of Holy Week. Tomorrow it begins, the sacred triduum, the 3 days around which the entirety of the church's year pivots. And we'll be talking a little bit more about the liturgy that we will celebrate as a part of that, that one liturgy that starts Holy Thursday evening with the Mass of the Lord's Supper and continues on through Easter. It is the Super Bowl, the Final Four, the NBA Finals, whatever you want to call it, the Masters, all wrapped into one. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in the second hour. I also want to talk some more about the Suffering Servant, this series of four songs that comprise our first reading Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday of this Holy Week, and how Jesus understood his mission and his messianic identity. A couple of guests on the show today. At the bottom of the hour, we're going to talk to Amy Howe. Amy, who's been on the program before, she is an attorney but also a blogger with SCOTUS Blog, one of my go-to blogs for news about what's happening at the nation's highest court. SCOTUS, of course, an acronym for the Supreme Court of the United States. But Amy's agreed to be on early in the morning before she has to carpool for school. Amy will be telling us a little bit about the case Zurbich versus Burwell, which is being heard today, which is also known more commonly as the Little Sisters of the Poor case. And it's rejection of the Obamacare mandate of the provision of contraception. Well, actually, their issue is even the exemption or the conscientious accommodation that has been provided for the religious order, the Little Sisters and their work, they consider that to be an infringement on their freedom as well, because it would involve providing information and, in their minds, facilitating something that they consider a grave evil. So we'll talk to Amy about that, what she expects to hear. One thing that they do at SCOTUS Blog is keep a pretty tight lid on their rooting interests in the case. So we'll just get from her more of the objective perspective of what we can expect in the case. I also want to ask her about the dynamics of the court since the passing of Justice Antonin Scalia. And then in the next hour, my regular monthly guest, Lisa Duffy. Lisa, who has her own blog on the Patheos channel, A Million Unheard Souls. She also blogs for Catholic Match. She has had and continues to have an exceptional ministry to divorced Catholics, divorced and separated. Wrote a book called Divorced Catholic, Now What? And then more recently, The Catholic Guide to Dating After Divorce. And Lisa does a really great work. And the thing that first drew me to Lisa's work was that she simultaneously affirmed the full teaching of the Catholic Church on the indissolubility of marriage. Unfortunately, a lot of resources that I had seen for divorced Catholics spent a lot of their energy rejecting Catholic teaching or angling to try to change it on the indissolubility of marriage. And of course, the Church is bound by the teaching of our Lord himself on that issue. So she simultaneously affirmed the Church's teaching, but exhibits great empathy for those in the midst of that struggle because she's lived it herself. And she'll be on to talk about why the grass is not necessarily always greener on the married side and the challenges of single divorced parents and how she admires their courage. So we'll get into all that with Lisa in the second hour. Certainly take your calls anytime during the program, 573-4BREAD-4. 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, and I'll give you the question of the day in the next segment. We'll also talk about John Kasich, why he may not be quite as nice as he seems, and a strange place for the theology of the body to pop up. Hope you had a great day yesterday. Certainly a tragic day as we follow the unfolding story in Belgium, the terrorist attacks in Brussels, just a nightmare. And one of those things after the attacks last fall in Paris. Now, these attacks, not only every major European city, I think every major city, if they are thinking at all, are imagining such a scenario playing out in their own communities, because it can. It's such a, I mean, it's amazing to me, to be honest with you, that we've not had similar type of events more common here in the United States? Because, I mean, let's face it, let's be realistic. I mean, these are soft targets, and ISIS and those of like mind, I mean, there's no limit to the kind of opportunities they have. If they want to wreak this kind of terror and havoc, there are a million soft targets, almost literally, that they could hit and create hysteria, which is what they've done in Brussels. And we certainly pray for all those who are recovering from their injuries, all those who are grieving the loss of a loved one, and for eternal rest and for repose for those who have perished in the attacks, and for justice to be brought against those perpetrators of these crimes. The other story, of course, we've been following is the story of Father Tom, the Salesian priest, Father Tom Uzhun Alil, Indian priest who was abducted there in Yemen by jihadi kidnappers. The good news is it says social media rumors that Father Tom will be crucified by jihadi kidnappers on Good Friday appear to be unfounded. This is from the Catholic News Agency. Yesterday, as we shared, the Franciscan Sisters of Siessen, based in South Africa, warned on Facebook of the impending torture, and the rumor has spread across social media platforms. But Salesian church officials have dismissed the claim as rumors and said they have no information about the priest's whereabouts or his situation. Father Matthew Valercourt said, "We have absolutely no information on Father Tom. The original rumor appears to have stemmed from an unverified email speculating about the possibility of torture and crucifixion." So continue to pray for Father Tom. As I said, he is in captivity right now. We do not know what his situation is, but we pray and continue to pray for peace and for the strength of those like Father Tom who are suffering to be able to stand for the faith and to find the comfort of God and the prayers of the saints in the midst of all that. Got to go last night to see a spring concert at our local Catholic high school, Lexington Catholic High School, where we broadcast from here in central Kentucky. Lexington Catholic, where all of our children have gone, our older children anyway. Our daughter, our fourth oldest daughter now, a senior. This was the 10th straight spring choir concert we've been to, because we've had at least one child at Lexington Catholic in the choir program every year since the fall of 2006, when our oldest daughter, who's now 23, entered the school. So this is old hat for us. But last night, as I said, our daughter Naomi, who is a senior, been very involved in the choir program, a fantastic choir program they have there at the school, not simply in terms of the music and what they're learning about music and voice, which is that in and of itself is excellent, but they really do find a place of community in the choir. And so I was enjoying the concert last night, watching it unfold. You know, my daughter's in an a cappella group. She's in the chamber choir. She, you know, most of the concert, she was a part of it. Of course, we got a son who's a freshman who's now getting into full swing with the choir program as well. But all was going well, and, you know, I wasn't thinking about it being my daughter's last concert until they began to sing the Fiddler on the Roof medley. And they began to sing the Fiddler on the Roof medley, and it was fine at first. I mean, who doesn't love Fiddler on the Roof? You know, the papa tradition, you know, and if I were a rich man, all that, you know, we were going through that, enjoying that very, very much. Then they had to go and have in the medley, of course, the most cruel song of them all. And I'm like, you know, is this the little boy at play? When did she grow to be such a beauty? Sunrise, sunset, really? I mean, that's just cruel and unusual punishment for a dad watching his daughter in her last high school choir concert. So I protest. I'm going to have to call them over at the school today and say that was just uncalled for. I like to try to hold it together in public, but that made it a little tough. 573-4-BREAD-4 if you want to chime in. 573-4-BREAD-4. It was a great concert, though, I have to admit. We're back into, of course, the Suffering Servant songs as we go through the first readings. Today's the third Suffering Servant song, the first reading of the Mass from Isaiah chapter 50. The Lord God has given me a well-trained tongue that I might know how to speak to the weary a word that will rouse them. Morning after morning, he opens my ear that I may hear, and I have not rebelled, have not turned back. I gave my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who plucked my beard, my face I did not shield from buffets and spitting. You know, there's no question that the earliest Christians saw in the Suffering Servant songs, the four songs there in the second part of Isaiah's work, as helping them get a grasp and understanding of how Jesus could be simultaneously Messiah and yet one who suffered tremendously. Because in the Jewish understanding, for the most part, the Messiah was one who would come with the power of God to restore Israel and defeat her enemies and to reign as Lord of the nations. How could they make sense of this one whom they had seen with their own eyes, had supernatural and divine authority and power, and yet suffered such ignominy and such destruction? Well, it was these suffering servant songs, that the suffering of this one was, in fact, freely chosen as a gift. We'll get into this more in the second hour. We'll be back with a question of the day and more. Amy Howe at the bottom of the hour. This is The Mike Allen Show. Minutes past the hour, you are back on the Mike Allen Show. Question of the day. We're going to be talking with Amy Howe at the bottom of the hour here in about 15 minutes about the case going before the Supreme Court today, the Little Sisters of the Poor case, Zurbich versus Burwell. Yet another challenge to the Affordable Care Act, which was passed actually on, was signed by the president into law on this day 6 years ago, back in 2010. So I'm asking a question about so-called universal health care, single-payer system, however you want to call it. Do you support or oppose in principle the idea of universal health care? Set aside the religious freedom issues that have been involved with the government's ham-handed overreach on issues like the contraceptive mandate, which is such a shame. It's so unnecessary because they would have had the full-throated support of the U.S. bishops, for one thing, the Obama administration would have had, if they were talking about health care reform that sought to help the uninsured have insurance, because from the Catholic perspective, health care is a human right. But they had to go and throw this stuff in there that just created enemies where they didn't need to have any, in my opinion. So setting all that stuff aside, do you support or oppose in principle the idea of universal health care? 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. You can call or text into that number, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post your response on Facebook or on Twitter. So we got a number of responses on Facebook already so far. Most of the responses have been those who support. Ann says support. Sandra says support. Beth says this: as a pediatrician, I will wholeheartedly voice my strongest support for single-payer universal health care. Our monetary investment should support patient care, not outrageous profits. Stephen offers a dissenting view. Stephen says oppose. Market solutions are always more efficient and effective than big government bureaucracy red tape solutions. Government was the original cause of the distortions in healthcare, in the healthcare market, beginning with wage freezes after World War II, which prompted the unintended effect of employer-based insurance to attract talent. The more government got involved, the more convoluted and distorted the market became, such as providing tax incentives for big business and not for individuals or small businesses, and restrictions on cross-state insurance. And it's just gotten worse the more rules and regulation and mandates have been piled on. So that's Stephen's point of view, and that's concurred with, I think, Dave and some others who comment as well. So, love to hear from you on this. Not sure where I come down on this. I think there's no question that our healthcare needs reform, or needed reform, big time. It's crazy. I mean, costs out of control. You do have an untenable situation where you have millions of people who are uninsured. And I think the nightmare scenarios that are oftentimes floated out there, or how bad they have it in countries where there is socialized medicine, are proving to oftentimes be not exactly always accurate reflections of how things are. And, from a Catholic perspective, I think we have to be really careful not to buy into this libertarian view of government, in which government is the enemy. Certainly, there are problems with bureaucratic bloating that happens not only in government, that happens in church institutions as well. But I think for the most part, the Catholic viewpoint of government is not to see government as a necessary evil, but that it can be a positive good. And so, I'd love your opinion and thought on this. 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. It's interesting because some of the comments I got, who are supporting universal health care in the Facebook thread anyway, are people I know who are otherwise politically conservative. I think that's one of the reasons that that Bernie Sanders has gotten a particular following. People appreciate what he has to say, even though there are plenty of others who think he's totally out to lunch and unrealistic. There is no free lunch. But anyway, I think an almost, Ayn Randian view of healthcare is a negative one as well. Everybody's got to stand on their own 2 feet. I'm not sure that jibes well with a Catholic worldview of the common good either. Do you support or oppose in principle the idea of universal health care? I would say, if push came to shove, I would say I support it. I could support it. 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4, email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. And if you're going to convince me of why that's a wrong position, in my opinion, you're going to have to take a different tack than government always messes things up. Because I don't think that's always true. I think there are things that government can do well. Yes, there are things that government does poorly. But I think there also can be things that government does well. Sports-wise, I was really sad to see the story yesterday that on Yahoo Sports, Craig Sager's doctor says that he likely has 3 to 6 months to live. TNT announcer Craig Sager, who typically this time of year, as we're getting into the stretch run of the NBA season and the playoffs, you see Craig Sager, known for his outrageous wardrobe, his sport coats in particular. He's been facing acute myeloid leukemia for the last 2 years. He's had swings both in and out of remission. Evidently, in an interview with HBO correspondent Bernard Goldberg, the 64-year-old broadcaster confirmed that doctors informed him in February that he was no longer in remission. The veteran sideline reporter, who has become an iconic figure, as it says, within the NBA world, thanks in part to his garish wardrobe and his frequent sparring sessions with Spurs head coach Greg Popovich, says he's now entering uncharted waters in his battle with leukemia, which began in April of 2014 and has included multiple courses of treatment. I have a real soft spot in my heart for Craig Sager because I can remember he used to be CNN used to have a nightly sports show, kind of like their own sports center, back when I was in college. So we were going back now, 30 years ago. I could remember being in the dorm, my best friend Mike, who unfortunately, we were very, very close, roommates, best men at each other's weddings. He died a very untimely death of cancer at the age of 24, and had been married just a little bit over a year when he passed away. A friend I still miss terribly, though he's now been gone over 25 years. But I can remember we would, every night, it was our routine. We'd, whatever we were working on, homework, shooting the bull, whatever, everything would come to a standstill. And we'd go to the common area of the dorm where they had a television, and we'd watch CNN Sports Tonight. And Craig Sager, you know, 30 years ago, a regular staple on Sports Tonight on CNN. So Craig Sager pulling for you, and for all those who are dealing and battling with cancer. No doubt. Of course, tomorrow we'll be back into the NCAA tournament again, the Sweet 16, starting tomorrow night's. Got to really work on getting myself into it again now that my Kentucky Wildcats have been eliminated. But I'll follow it. I just don't know how. It's hard for me to get emotionally involved. So we'll see how it plays out, and we'll be standing here, I guess, Monday talking about who the Final Four is. Anyway, let's get on to our What Were You Thinking nominees of the day. We've got a few qualified candidates. Spanning the globe looking for examples of human beings not thinking, and be grateful that in these occasions it's not you. Victim not fooled by toy gun during attempted robbery. This out of Maplewood, Missouri. A man facing charges after police say he tried to rob a Maplewood business at gunpoint using a fake gun. Well, it's not uncommon, I guess. But the owner of the Soul Survivor leather store told the police that he feared for his life for a moment before realizing a multicolored water pistol was being pointed directly at him. Here's the thing. If you could go with the toy gun, make sure it's black and not multicolored. Officials say Emmanuel Perkins allegedly demanded money. Then the victim pushed the toy gun away and kicked him out before the police came to arrest him. All right, excellent. How about this? Angry man spends $200 at sushi restaurant, leaves 13-foot python instead of a tip. Evidently, Hiroshi Motohashi was angry when the management of the sushi restaurant, I don't know if the bill was too high, they asked him to leave. Instead of dropping the mic after a memorable rant, officials say the 46-year-old man dropped a 13-foot-long snake in the middle of the restaurant, then left. He was later arrested on suspicion of making criminal threats. Really? He'd first brought in a smaller snake he was showing the other customers, which they didn't appreciate. And then he brings in the 13-foot python. Fortunately, nobody was hurt. But the winner, and I meant to share this yesterday and ran out of time. This was on Craigslist out of San Diego. Somebody wrote this: to whoever broke into my car and stole stuff. Last night you broke into my car and stole some things. Naturally, I feel violated, angry, and upset. But more overwhelming is my emotion of confusion. Were you, like, really high when this heist occurred? Here are the things you stole. 60 pounds of cat food. $15 worth of nurse instruments. A Ziploc bag full of unmarked feline anti-diarrheal pills. Have fun with those. Things you didn't steal. $500 worth of electronics in the backseat. $1,000 worth of surgical instruments, controlled drugs, veterinary opioids, several clients, clearly marked in the front seat. P.S., if you'd like some insulin syringes, I have about 700 more expired donated ones. I can only assume that you are poor and have a diabetic cat with explosive diarrhea. That's pretty good. We'll be back with Amy Howe, SCOTUS Blog, Mike Allen Show. We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show. Pleased to have as a guest Amy Howe. Amy, who is the editor at SCOTUS Blog. SCOTUS, of course, an acronym for the Supreme Court of the United States. It's my go-to source on information about the nation's highest court. She's also served as counsel in over 24 merit cases at the Supreme Court and has argued 2 cases there. She also has co-taught Supreme Court litigation at Stanford Law School as well as Harvard Law School, and she's an adjunct professor at American University's Washington College of Law and Vanderbilt Law School, and a graduate of Georgetown University Law Center. She's up early before the carpool begins with her kids. Amy, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
So it's not too crazy at your house right now?
Not yet. Give me another 10 or 15 minutes.
I'm a little disappointed that my Kentucky Wildcats lost last weekend because, according to your Twitter handle or bio, you're a Tar Heel fan. We could have talked a little smack because they'd be playing this Thursday night.
Exactly. I have to admit, I was not devastated when Kentucky lost. It sort of helped open up Carolina's bracket a little bit.
Yes, North Carolina, Indiana, that's almost like, for me, North Korea playing against Iran or something. You know, I'm not sure who I'll cheer for there.
It's like Lindsey Graham, you know, a couple of months ago on Donald Trump versus Ted Cruz.
Yeah, Lindsey Graham.
Choose me or poison me.
Yeah, Lindsey Graham in a rare moment of a political honesty there, I guess. Anyway, no, it's great to have you with us this morning. I know you're a veteran observer of the Supreme Court. Before we get into this Zurbich versus Burwell case, which is going to unfold today, this Little Sisters of the Poor case and the Affordable Care Act, tell me your own perspective on what the passing of Justice Antonin Scalia. I mean, love him or loathe him, I mean, he was a guy that could not be ignored and certainly an overwhelming presence, I'm sure, on the court.
That's right. One of the late justices, it was either Byron White or Lewis Powell, said that every time the court gets a new justice, it becomes a different court, you know, implying because the dynamic changed. And that really also seems to be the case with the loss of Justice Scalia on February 13th. That the Supreme Court is what's known as a hot bench. If you are a lawyer arguing there, you can expect a lot of questions. You can expect that you may not get out more than one or two sentences before another justice asks you yet another question. And that hot bench, most people actually date back to the arrival of Justice Scalia in the mid-1980s. And so it really has changed. You know, it's not just that they lost one of the nine justices, but they lost really a key member at oral arguments. He was always the one with a lot of questions. And the other justices have not necessarily stepped in to fill the void. You also get the sense that they are still mourning his loss. And so, you know, generally it's been a little bit unusual. You had Justice Clarence Thomas, who, it was well documented, had not asked a question for almost 10 years, in one of the arguments earlier this month, starts asking a whole series of questions. And at the beginning of March, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a challenge to Texas's abortion regulations. And the court's more liberal justices were really giving the Texas lawyer defending the regulations a hard time. And I remember coming away thinking that Justice Scalia would not have let that happen. And then this week, the court had been observing a 30-day period of mourning for Justice Scalia. And so during the oral arguments at the end of February and the beginning of March, his seat was empty and then it was draped in black crepe. But when the justices returned for oral arguments on Monday, that his seat was gone, and they'd all switch their seats because they sit in order of seniority. The Chief Justice is in the middle, and then the most senior justice, which used to be Justice Scalia, is to his right. So when he moved, all of the seats moved. And at one point, one of the lawyers was effectively looking for Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who used to sit on your far left if you're the arguing lawyer. He's looking over there, and finally she had to say, "Counsel, I'm over here." So everyone's a little bit disoriented. No one has really sort of settled in yet to, you know, the new order, for lack of a better word.
I think those justices are a good model for the rest of the country in this very partisan atmosphere we have right now, because even though you can certainly read Justice Scalia's dissents, which were usually more fun to read than his majority decisions, even with the just sometimes, you know, scathing dissents he would offer, they really were, I mean, friends, even across the ideological spectrum, and I guess most famously, he and Justice Ginsburg.
That's right. I mean, not only have they traveled together, Justice Kagan has gone on hunting trips with Justice Scalia, but the Scalia and Ginsburg families traditionally celebrated New Year's Eve together every single year. And Justice Sotomayor actually commented on it recently, talking about Justice Scalia, and you know, she basically said we're like a family. And sometimes he was the annoying brother, but you know, at the end of the day, you know, he was still my brother. And they would get on each other's nerves, particularly at the end of June when they're all working quite hard and issuing the decisions in the high-profile cases. And then they go, you know, they go away on their summer vacations, and they come back, and they really are all friends again.
Well, let's talk about this case today because it promises to be a big one. Another challenge to the Affordable Care Act, Zubik versus Burwell, probably known more popularly as the Little Sisters of the Poor case. Maybe can you give us an idea of what we can expect to hear in arguments today?
Sure. And yes, the Little Sisters of the Poor, it's called Zubik versus Burwell because the case filed by David Zubik, who I believe is the Archbishop of Pittsburgh, was filed before the Little Sisters of the Poor, but you know, it is popularly known as the Little Sisters of the Poor case because it's such a great image. But so the Affordable Care Act, in a nutshell, the Affordable Care Act had regulations promulgated under it that require employers to provide their female employees with health insurance that includes access to certain forms of birth control. And 2 years ago, in a case called Burwell versus Hobby Lobby. Burwell is the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. The Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision with Justice Scalia in the majority, joining the other more conservative justices, held that a closely held corporation owned by devoutly religious owners can't be required to provide this health insurance with access to birth control, can't be required to provide the access to birth control to their female employees if they have religious objections. The owners of a company called Hobby Lobby and then another company said that for them, because of their religious beliefs, providing this access to birth control was essentially the same as being complicit in abortion because of the way the forms of birth control work. And the court said, yes, you don't have to provide this access to birth control. And one of the things that the court pointed to was that religious nonprofits like the Little Sisters of the Poor, like religious colleges, can opt out of providing this access by filling out a form or notifying the government through a letter. And they said that these closely held corporations with religious objections should be able to do the same thing. And so now a group of religious nonprofits and religious colleges like the Little Sisters of the Poor are back at the Supreme Court, and their argument is that even having to opt out violates their rights, not under the Constitution, but under a federal law known as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, because even opting out, even if they are not directly providing the access to birth control to their female employees, they're still participating in it because the government is using the health insurance infrastructure that they've set up.
We're here with Amy Howe of SCOTUSblog.com talking about today's Zubik versus Burwell case, this challenge to the Obamacare contraception mandate related to the Little Sisters of the Poor and some others. Does the whole thing really hinge on who determines what a substantial burden is on one's religious practice, whether the religious group in question or whether the government makes that decision?
That is certainly one of the things that is at issue. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act prohibits the government from imposing a substantial burden on someone's ability to practice his religion unless the government can meet two criteria, unless they can show that the burden advances an important government interest and it does so in the least restrictive means possible. So the Supreme Court could decide this in any number of ways. And one of the questions is, and a lot of friends of the court have also focused on this, you know, who gets to decide what a substantial burden is? Is it enough for the Little Sisters of the Poor to say this is a substantial burden, or do courts sort of look behind the curtain to try and figure out whether or not this is a substantial burden? The court could decide it on one of the other issues, you know, whether this is an important government interest, the government says that it is, whether or not it does so in the least restrictive means possible. One of the other things that the religious nonprofits, like the Little Sisters of the Poor, point to is that there are a lot of people that don't have to comply, a lot of employers that don't have to comply even with the opt-out. Groups like churches don't have to provide access to their employees to birth control, and they don't have to fill out any forms. And so that, you know, the idea is that perhaps there is a better way to do this without, as they would say, hijacking their insurance infrastructure.
Do you think people will be, well, I mean, you've got five of the eight remaining justices who are Catholic, at least nominally so, and then you've got these little sisters, you know, and just the visual imagery of a habited religious sister. You think that's going to be something people keep an eye on?
Yeah, I think it does sort of increase the profile of the case, certainly. There's an awful lot going on right now at the Supreme Court, but also in politics with the Republican and Democratic presidential primary races going on, and certainly with the events in Brussels. But it's certainly going to garner right. some headlines, at least for a couple of days, and the sort of visual impact from those groups like the Little Sisters of Poor will certainly be large.
Amy, we're out of time, unfortunately. Always enjoy it. Thank you very,
great
very much.
Thank you.
Have a great
right.
carpool, a
yeah,
great rest of your week. And I can't say go Tar Heels, but we'll see. All right. Take
Thanks
care.
Thanks so much.
We'll be back in a minute. The Mike Allen Show.
Chaka Khan, Chaka Khan, Chaka Khan, Chaka Khan, let me rock it, let me rock it, Chaka Khan. Let me rock it, that's all I wanna do. Chaka Khan, let me rock it, let me rock it, Chaka Khan. Let me rock it, let me feel for you. Chaka Khan, what you tell me what you wanna do? Do you feel for me the way I feel for you? Chaka Khan, let me tell you what I wanna do. I wanna love you, wanna hug you, wanna squeeze you too. But let me take it in my arm, let me feel you with my charm, Chaka.
15 minutes before the hour.
Make it more than just a physical dream.
I'm trying to get, I can't remember when in this song Chaka Khan actually comes in. Let's see. Maybe this is it right here. This song was number one. I can't remember which year I put down that it was number one. It had to be back in the 80s. Leave it up there, Ethan, just for a minute. I'm going to see if she comes in here. By the way, I used Chaka Khan as a really bad... There we go. I'm not sure who the guy is with her, but... I used her name, of course, in a really bad pun after Chaka Smart, who coaches the Texas Longhorns, lost their game to Northern Iowa. I said, when it comes to beating Northern Iowa as a coach, Chaka Khan. Anyway, that was bad. Was that really worth that much time? I doubt it. 5734-BREAD-4, 5734-BREAD-4. Really enjoyed that conversation with Amy Howe. I probably got into the details of the Zubik versus Burwell case a little bit too late, these automatically timed breaks. I had to do a little jab at her Tar Heel fandom, though. You know, I had to get that in there. But Amy, obviously... A very bright mind, somebody who observes the court well. She's a great resource. SCOTUS blog, an excellent source. Like I said, I think they strive really hard to be to not be partisan and to keep their own particular perspectives on what they hope happens on the court to themselves. Just give us a good vision of it. You know, one of the questions I think about this case with the religious, one concern that I've seen raised from some is that this is a risky sort of case for the issue of religious liberty. Because if, for example, there is a sense in which the Little Sisters and those representing them are overreaching, overstating what the substantial burden is, that it could have damaging and precedent-inducing effects on other claims of religious liberty. Because that's what it boils down to, ultimately, is who decides whether something is a substantial burden or not. Obviously, that cannot be an unlimited right in the sense that, for example, the government has laws against polygamy, for example. And someone could have said at a certain point in our nation's history that they had religious convictions behind their desire for polygamy, and that laws against polygamy presented a substantial burden to the practice of their faith. So who determines what's a substantial burden? I think that's one of the tricky things about this case, and we'll certainly be keeping on it. I do think that dynamic, you with five of the eight justices remaining being Catholic, at least nominally so, there's either the danger that they could be viewed as being overly sympathetic, the Catholic justices, to habited religious sisters who will obviously be in the courtroom, or it could have the opposite effect, That we want to show that we're not. Because I would imagine these justices pay attention. They're sensitive to the charge that they're trying to impose their faith on the populace. Could it have a negative effect to where they want to go the other direction to prove they're not beholden to Catholic interests? So we'll keep an eye on that. Maybe we can get Amy back on as we're getting closer to having their decision released. And the questioning will tell us something. It usually does as well. Speaking of the Supreme Court, a funny clip. I don't know if you ever see Jimmy Kimmel. He's a late night talk show host, of course. And he has this feature called Lie Witness News, and where they go out on the street and they say these ridiculous things to people. And what they've determined is when people don't know something about something, they will never admit it. They will rather lie and pretend it's a legitimate question just because they're on TV. And so this edition of Lie Witness News took them out on the street about this was just after the president announced who his nominee was going to be for the vacant Supreme Court seat. But of course they don't use the name of the actual nominee. They make up some names and ask people's opinions. So here's this edition from a few days ago of Jimmy Kimmel's Lie Witness News.
What's your name and where are you from?
I'm Olga from Long Beach.
Olga, this morning President Obama announced his nominee for Supreme Court Justice. How do you think Whitey Bulger will do as a Supreme Court Justice?
I hope he can make it. I just hope. I know that the Republicans are going to attack him. I've seen that this morning.
Do you think Whitey's criminal past will have an effect on his ability to get confirmed by the Senate, or it'll be okay?
It'll be okay.
Whitey Bulger, a notorious gangster, of course.
Well, this morning, President Obama announced his Supreme Court Justice nominee, straight out of England, George Harrison. How do you think he'll do?
I think he'll do great. He has the most accomplishments of any Supreme Court nominee ever, from what I heard, 18 years. So I think he has the bones to do the job.
Do you think Sammy Hagar is a good choice for Supreme Court Justice?
I feel that the motions that he is for and the laws and things that he wants to change and everything like that, I think that he would be a good candidate for the role.
What about his laws that no one can drive 55? Do you think that'll be sort of a hindrance or?
I think it's just depending on the person. Some things that people are for or people are against, it just depends on who actually is for or against in the society. I don't have a problem with it.
What did you think when you heard that President Obama nominated L. Ron Hubbard to the Supreme Court? Are you excited?
Yeah, I am. I thought it was a good choice because he's more Republican. I identify myself as a Republican, so I was pretty content with that choice.
Do you think that replacing swearing on the Bible with an e-meter in the Supreme Court is a good idea to read people's statements before they testify?
I would say yes, I do, just so that it's a thing as a national one. Not everyone swears on the Bible and believes in that, so it's just more of a thing to keep it one.
President Obama nominated Tyrion Lannister for Supreme Court Justice. Do you think that
That's a Game of Thrones character, I believe.
All Seven Kingdoms, or he'll be a divisive figure?
I think he's going to be divisive.
All right, so that gives you a little window into the future of our republic. Oh, my goodness. That is scary stuff, but really, really funny. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. Of course, I haven't checked to see what went on. I should have done that. I'm falling down on the job to see how the primaries went yesterday. There were a few primaries, of course, yesterday. And in Arizona, for example, let me see if I can pull this up here, whether or not Donald Trump, I think they were expecting Donald Trump would probably win Arizona. Let's see, ABC News projects Donald Trump is the winner of the Arizona Republican primary, and looks like Ted Cruz won the Utah primary. Again, no surprise there. So I'm not sure that a lot has really changed. Of course, John Kasich winning neither of these. Now, I did read an interesting piece by Molly Ball about John Kasich. This is from The Atlantic. Why John Kasich is still standing. It's mathematically impossible for the Ohio governor to win the nomination in the primaries, but he still likes his chances. Talks about, you know, how he's holding on, hoping to get to a contested convention, of course, and he thinks he could possibly be a good compromise candidate. But one of the interesting things Molly Ball, who has been a longtime political observer, and particularly of John Kasich, talked about his personality and why it may not be exactly what it seems. Because one of the things that you see of John Kasich when you see at the debate, he's the guy who doesn't get down into the mud with the other candidates. He tries to be above the fray. He tries to, you know, see himself as a very conciliatory figure and so forth. But that may not be always an accurate reflection of his personality. In fact, Molly Ball says there is, this was in a profile she wrote a couple of, or last year, she said there is another side to Kasich. Quote, he's kind of a jerk. She's more specific. She says lobbyists in Columbus warn their clients before meeting the governor not to take it personal if he berates them. A top Ohio Republican donor once publicly vowed not to give Kasich a penny after finding him to be unpleasantly arrogant. As a congressman, Kasich sometimes lashed out at constituents. One who called him a redneck in a 1985 letter got a reply recommending he enroll in a remedial course on protocol. And when Kasich was thrown out of a Grateful Dead concert for trying to join the band on stage, he allegedly threatened to use his clout to have the band banned from D.C. And Ball continues, as I was writing this article, Kasich's press secretary, Rob Nichols, helpfully emailed me the thesaurus entry for prickly, sensing that I would need it. And she said those descriptions were written before Donald Trump got into the race and upended Kasich's and every other candidate's calculations. Early on in the campaign, it seemed like Kasich might try to compete with Trump for the pitchforks and torches crowd by emphasizing the ranty, unfiltered part of his demeanor. But at some point, he and his advisors clearly calculated that staying on the sunny side of the street was the way to stand out, even if it made him seem painfully out of step with the times. I will not take the low road to the highest office in the land, he said on Tuesday. His sunniness has made Kasich the candidate who contrasts most sharply with Trump and other remaining candidate, Ted Cruz, in both tone and platform. So, you know, I guess what I'm saying here is evidently that this piece, things are not always as they seem. Now, this makes sense in dovetailing with a conversation that I had with an Ohioan who has somewhat significant influence in the state and has met the governor of Ohio before. And he told me months ago that he didn't really personally like John Kasich very much, even though maybe his policies he was fine with, but that he was not the nicest person to work with. So it just goes to show, during political season, you never know who a person who really is. Of course, we believe, certainly as Catholics, always ongoing conversion. Certainly pray John Kasich comes back to the practice of his Catholic faith from his Anglican background. But just a little more detail behind the scenes of Mr. Kasich. Love to hear from you if you want to call in. 573-4BREAD-4. We'll be back with a new hour. This is The Mike Allen Show.